Welcome to the VoxGig Developer Relations Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Roger. I speak to people in the software development community about developer relations, public speaking, and community events. I'm the CEO of VoxGig, a software consultancy that builds DevRel tools. Because we believe in the power of community, we host a monthly virtual online meetup for everyone in developer relations. Check out devrelmeetup.com. And visit voxgig.com to view our work, use our tools, and sign up for our newsletter. Okay. Please sit back and enjoy my fireside chat with today's guest.
We are continuing our deep dive on building APIs by talking to Mike Amundsen. Mike knows a thing or two about building enterprise APIs, and we go deep on that subject. And if you're in developer relations, or just development in general, and you're feeling a little bit nervous about what AI means, well, myself and Mike, both being graybeards, discuss taking a cyclical view of all these new things that appear every 10 to 15 years. Long story short, there's nothing to worry about, folks. Alrighty, let's talk to Mike.
Mike, welcome to the Fireside with VoxGig podcast, talking about developer relations. We had a slight hitch because, St. Patrick's Day comes first. I hope you don't mind.
Not at all.
Awesome. Well, it is great to finally have you on. Okay, good place to start is, who is Mike Amundsen and what do you do?
I ask that question of myself very often, but the general answer, I've worked for the last 20 years in some kind of API space early on in enterprises, more and more in the web space, especially in the last 10 years or so. I've written a lot of articles, a handful of books on the topic of APIs and the web and services and that sort of thing, and worked with companies all over the world, large and small, who've taught me how they're using APIs and how they're reaching out to their communities to solve problems. And it's been a wonderful experience. And I continue to learn something new every single day from people all around the world. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome. And then part of the reason I invited you on to the podcast was to explore the differences between building APIs when you're small in a startup and building slash managing, right? Because if you work in enterprise, you often, there's an API already, you just have to manage it. And dealing with APIs in the enterprise, and I don't quite mean at scale, right? Because some enterprise APIs, of course, have quite low usage. The real work is in dealing with the organization behind it. Well, I mean, let's start with the surface details. Okay, what's easy to identify as the differences, and let's maybe go deep then on some.
Well, there's a handful of things. I think on a small organization, one of the advantages you have is there's a lot of agreement in a small group, right? There's this notion that if there's only five or six of us, we don't need to write a lot of memos. We're all sitting around the same table. We're all trying to solve the same general problem. We understand each other really well. And in particular, if you're slow, if you're dogging it, if you're not doing your job, everybody knows it. As you get bigger and bigger, that gets harder and harder to do. It's harder and harder to keep everyone on the same path. It's harder and harder to understand everyone's problems or situations or challenges. So I think when you start out, usually if you're working on an API program of any kind, even if it's just a small team inside another organization, there aren't a lot of encumbrances and you can move pretty fast. Yeah. You can even, if it's just your group, you can even do the classic Facebook move of move fast and break things because nobody else is affected. Yeah. But once you start to grow out of that, once you attract a crowd, once you have other people who want to use your service or use your API or are requesting you to start doing something else, now it changes. And now it's harder to move as fast. It's easier to break things and have negative consequences. So I think one of the big differences, as you might characterize it, between a small startup and, say, an enterprise, even if it's just a small group inside an enterprise, is there's a lot more community. There's a lot more interaction. There are a lot more people. There are a lot more non-technical challenges. Some of these are design, but a lot of them are just adoption. That tends to change the tenor, and in some ways, even the technique that you'd use to solve a problem, I think.
When companies hire you, Mike, is it primarily to address those types of issues?
solve cross-functional problems, or where do you come in?
Yeah, actually, I would say it, that's true, even if sometimes my potential partner doesn't know that.
Yeah.
Some people I work with think, you know what, if we could just get to GraphQL, if we could just get to REST or Protobuf, they have sort of a technical target, and they think things will be better if we can just reach this technical target of some kind. And of course, that's really, experience says that's not really the case. It's a people operation. There's politics in the real true meaning of that word. There's a polity, there's a group of people. And understanding your target audience, understanding what they need and how they would like that delivered and when they would like that delivered, that is really the challenge. And in larger organizations, which I tend to talk to larger groups because they have a much bigger challenge in this space, a lot of it has to do with thinking about a product platform, a mix of all sorts of things, and not being some sort of pure, everybody's doing it the same way kind of work. A lot of this has to do with the way different teams approach the same general problems with different tools, with different practices, and how you can get those people to work together. And I think that's a big part, a bigger part of the job than some people assume.
Yeah, and I mean, it doesn't sound like there's any quick fixes, but I do want to raise the sort of famous, I think people often call it the Bezos directive, right? Where Jeff Bezos said, okay, everything has to be an API and it has to be externalizable so people outside the company can use it. And that magically fixed all the problems. Is that really what happened?
Yes. So this, you're referring to what's called sometimes the Yegi rant. This is an individual who had worked for Amazon and then moved to Google and all of a sudden was just aghast at what they discovered. Yeah, the AWS story, like the Spotify story, like the Netflix story, we tend to carry these stories around. Every one of those has some lesson in them. I have talked to people at AWS, and they definitely tell me that some of that is true, that there was a mandate and that you're going to be doing it this way, and if you don't like it, you can go somewhere else. All that part is true.
Yeah.
But I think we may misinterpret some of the details or some of the context in what's going on, and especially on things like you have to use an interface and the interface must be externalizable kind of thing. One of the other things that's famous in the Amazon community is a distaste for meetings, a distaste for getting a lot of well-paid individuals into the same room to argue about things. This is a cultural no-no at Amazon. One of the reasons that this talk of externalizable was so powerful is to treat the other API or treat the other team like another company. Think about it. When you're creating your API and you're trying to integrate your API with other APIs and you're using Salesforce and you discover, you know, Salesforce doesn't really do it quite the way I want. Maybe I'll call up Salesforce and say, you know what? I want to do a PR. You guys should change your API to be like this. Well, you don't do that with, you don't do that with Salesforce and SAP and all these other people, right? You treat them as an external partner. So one of the messages at the in the Amazon space is treat all of them like external partners. Use the documentation, use the examples they give you, use the API. If you can make it work, fine. If not, throw it away. So it has to do with the way you treat each other. In other words, we can't have a meeting and change the data model just because you want some feature. And that encourages you to start rethinking how you design the API, how you deploy the API, how you document the API. And that is, I think, one of the messages of that Yegi rant story.
And yet the irony is the outcome of that is that Amazon's API seems highly unified when you interact with it, right? It has a unified permissions model.
Yeah.
Things tend to follow the same basic conceptual structures. Is that just a natural outcome of that approach?
No. It's not. There are other forces inside Amazon. One of the ones that was characterized this way: you can do whatever you want to solve the problem, but if you don't use our tools and it doesn't work, you're fired.
Which
is a kind of a, know what? They already built authentication. Let me go ahead and use their authentication. There's already a team doing data storage. Let me use the data storage. So there's another level to this, which is it doesn't make sense for me to go off on my own if there's already something there. And that's also cultural. Now, I will tell you that at the same time, I remember talking specifically, reuse is not a cultural touchstone at AWS. At least it wasn't when I was talking to them several years ago. You can use whatever you want, just make sure it works. And that means that there are lots of copies of things across the globe. They do lots and lots of stuff all over the world. But I think the point you're making here is this notion of use what's already there is pretty deeply embedded inside the AWS community. And that means that the APIs that are well done get used quite a bit at a pretty high level inside Amazon.
So what are the lessons that we should take from that for if you're a non-tech enterprise, right? A bank, telco, I suppose telco is sort of on the edge, right?
Yeah.
Petrochemical company or something. And they have software in the world. Everybody has to build APIs.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, what are the lessons? But secondly, should you be taking those lessons? Right? I mean, is Amazon really the guiding star to follow?
Yeah. So the short answer is Amazon really the guiding star to follow? The answer is no.
Oh, okay.
Neither is Spotify, neither is Netflix. They're examples, and there may be some good things there, but every company is different. Every culture is different. Mm-hmm. Whether you're in manufacturing or services or, the things you talked about, like exploratory mining, there's millions and millions of opportunities out there for APIs. APIs are there to solve a business problem. And I think that's one of the touchstones elements. And that's one of the things that Amazon does really well. They're solving their business problem. And their business problem is unlike almost everyone else's on the planet at scale and even at audience. So the thing that I talk to people a lot about is, why do you have this API? What business problem is it solving? If you're doing OKRs and KPIs and all these things about trying to understand your business and get it integrated, pay attention to what business problem this API is solving, and pay attention to whether or not it's doing it well. So that even if you say, look, we're trying to reduce the time it takes to solve a customer's complaint or resolve a ticket or get a custom built item out the door, whatever it is you're trying to do, how does this API contribute to that? And where is the evidence? And once you have that evidence, is that really at the level that you're hoping for? Can we make it better? And if it's not doing what we need it to do, or if the job is done, we actually needed it to convert all of our catalog information from one platform to another, retire it, let it go, move on, because we're here to solve a business problem. Oh, and I think that's the way to think about it.
Yeah, and that brings us into the lifecycle question using API management tools and that sort of stuff. So where do you stand on that, right? Do you just build your own API and deploy to the cloud and you're done? Or if you're, again, let's say a non-software enterprise, should you really be using an API management system? Because you're just not going to have the internal skill sets to do that.
Well, yeah, the short answer is yes, you do need an API management solution. You have to manage your APIs, even if you have one. You may not need a platform to do that. You may be able to do that in-house, but you've got to solve that problem. You've got to know what the story is, what the life cycle is on your particular API. It's pretty rare to have only one. There's almost always
now they
more
start
than
breeding.
One API.
They start multiplying once you have one, right?
Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Before you know it, they're like tribbles. They're everywhere. So you definitely need to think about a sort of a portfolio management notion. Think about any company, whatever their products and services are, they have a portfolio, they have a life cycle, they have an audience, they pay attention to all these kinds of things. Your APIs are the same way as well. So they're enabling some part of the business. How's that part of the business doing? How are they doing at enabling? The other thing to keep in mind is when you have a collection of APIs, the more APIs you have, the more likely that one of them is not working properly at the moment. This is a feature, not a bug. There's a book called Systemantics, and I don't remember the author's name, but one of the axioms from that is, at any moment in any complex system, some part of it is not operating properly. So you get used to the idea that change is a very important part of API management, that there's always going to be a need for an upgrade or a change or a modification or a rewrite or something. That's part of the system. I think one of the things that's really fascinating to me about API lifecycle is primarily the part from design to build to deploy is the shortest part of that lifecycle. The bigger picture is the runtime and the maintenance and the modification and eventually the retirement.
Well,
that's a much longer thing.
Let me ask you then, Mike, right? So this gets to the heart of challenges that I've seen with our clients and with clients and with a lot of APIs in general is the awareness levels that senior leadership has, what they're getting themselves into. Because we did our API project. Yay! Project was successful. Delivered on time. It's live.
Right.
You know, right. Pat on the head.
Yep.
Okay. And then all the problems start because you have to run the damn thing.
Yes.
Exactly. And there seems to be, I don't know, would you call it naivety? I don't know. Around the fact that once you have an API and it has to be run in production, as you say, that's 99% of the cost.
Yeah. Well, see, here's the way I think about it. I'm not sure naivete is the right way to characterize it. I think there's a lot of selling of this same attitude as well. You know, if you just get the API in, you just get our product in, you just do it my way, the method, you know, the Amundsen method number 32, you're going to be fine. Any company that is manufacturing anything, that is out there selling anything, they've got equipment that has to be maintained. They've got all sorts of systems that have to be reviewed over time.
Yes.
They do that all the time anyway. APIs are no different. I agree with you that a lot of times I find evidence that there isn't enough attention to that 99%. But it's no different than any other piece of hardware or equipment that I might use. And when I'm manufacturing some things that I sell or packaging or anything that I would do, there's all sorts of office equipment and material that needs maintenance. And when you acquire that building, you know you've got a big maintenance cost involved. And it's the same for APIs, in my opinion.
We don't have a strong culture, maintenance culture in software. It's mostly our fault, right? Because we're so project oriented.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it was Roy Fielding, the REST guru, who made some comment like basically saying that software developers are not good at long term, like thinking about the effect of this on years on and things like that. You think about. The immediate, you think about getting it to release, and you know, release is a big event. We have a party and you know all that kind of thing. But often we don't think about what are the knock-on effects that are, you know, year after year. What did I just get myself into? I think is sort of the way to think about it. We don't do too well at that. So I think we need more of that. And it may be just sort of a life cycle or a curve of the industry itself. That we're now in a situation where we've got organizations that have APIs that are more than 10 years old. You know, the S3 API for Amazon, right? Was it 15 years old? Salesforce is like 20 years old or something like that. So maybe we're just getting to realizing that that's part of the story that we have to focus on.
So, I mean, are you starting to see this as as becoming a thing, an activity in the enterprise, API maintenance as a separate activity?
What I'm seeing is a real focus on this idea, this notion of management. Like we've sort of talked about it here briefly, this API management, and people are sort of aiming their products and their pitches at this. That to me is evidence that there's an awareness of this notion of maintenance and long-term. And I hear all these things about single pane of glass and how do I manage my async APIs and my GraphQL APIs and my resource HTTP APIs in the same way. I think we're just sort of traveling a path this is probably going to tweak people a little bit, but I've been thinking about this recently. I think we're experiencing a little bit of challenge because I'm just going to say it, because I think vendors have been leading the thinking on a lot of this API lifecycle work, and there isn't a lot of easily available and accessible research and content about product management in general as it applies to IT. There's lots of product management literature. There's actually a great deal of DevOps literature that like the technical side. Yeah. But in terms of what we started talking about, this idea of community and developer relations and all these other kinds of things, you have to dig a little deeper. You have to dig a little harder into papers and academics and things like that before you start to find, I think, some of the nuggets about this notion of long-term maintenance. So I think we need to get better at that a little bit, and I'm trying to contribute a little bit, but it's a tough thing. We need a large audience, I think, to talk more and more about the community side and the maintenance side of this API space.
Yeah, I mean, we're this is a developer relations podcast, but we couldn't have had this discussion 10 years ago. The technical challenges might have been the same, but
yeah,
I mean, who'd heard of that term, right? I know Apple invented it 20 years ago, but it wasn't really a thing. It was like, oh, you know, that's the guy who speaks at conferences.
Well, I think the amazing, you know, you mentioned Apple. I think the amazing thing from that experience is, you know, Apple understood very early on about the importance of community and context. And it isn't just technicalities. It isn't just hardware. It's how it's used and when it's used and who is using it and all these other things. And that's what developer relations helps us do, right? Is stay grounded. Who's our audience and what is their problem? We're solving our audience's problem, not our problem. I'm building an API not to solve my producer problem. Yeah, I'm building an API to solve the consumer problem. So we've got more than enough examples of it. And we just have to, I think, be a little bit more creative in applying it to the API space.
So maybe that's the thing to learn from Amazon and Salesforce and others like them, is their community efforts, right? The amount of effort they put into, you know, Dreamforce and reInvent and all of those conferences, having ambassador programs.
Yep.
But then it's, you know, it's not just headline conferences, it's kind of all the way down. And you do see, some of the newer startups having their own conferences and that sort of thing. What I don't see yet much is the older generation of companies that now have APIs having developer events for their APIs.
That's a good observation. I think that's right. You know, there are sort of different strata or different groupings of community, right? There's API consumers. There's API consumers for a particular product. There's API consumers for a particular, vertical. There's sort of a lot of pieces to this puzzle.
Yeah.
I think what we don't see also is the day-to-day work on market research and user interface and all these other things that are pretty well known for user-facing activity, sort of like, you know, UI and buttons and knobs. That same kind of activity needs to be going on for machine to machine. How do I make it easy for a developer to solve this problem so they can find the API, they can discover it, find it, use it, understand it, apply it, monitor it, and modify it over time in an easy way? I'm not sure we're aware of how much work is happening there. And I'm not sure. I see organizations investing. We call it developer relations, but it's really relations, right? It's it's product. It's product management and service. And I think we're just starting to see more and more of that. And it's gone on for consumer products for decades. I think we're just seeing more and more of it in IT.
So if we had had this discussion 2 years ago, I would have been nodding and saying, yes, okay, and that's what we need to advocate for, more of that. And I would have felt very confident that we would get there eventually and educate leadership and all that sort of stuff. With the advent of generative AI, you knew I was coming to this topic.
Oh, yeah.
I have a little bit of a little bit more nervousness around this issue, because now we're also fighting a potential view that, oh, we don't need developers anymore.
Yeah. But that's kind of always been there, right? I mean, we don't need developers anymore. We have low code, no code.
Yes.
We don't need developers anymore. We have fourth generation applications, to use the 1980s and 90s version, right? We've kind of always touched on this a little bit. I mean, AI definitely has changed the landscape, and I applaud organizations like OpenAI who figured out how to kind of viralize this current round of research into creating generative AI and LLMs and stuff like that. I think there's an amazing job being done to capture the attention that hasn't happened in a very long time. But I'm not sure I see any fundamental difference in how it's going to affect an organization. Organizations have used, we call them expert systems or learning systems or automation of some kind or robotics or we've been doing this for, half a century or more. And it always offers some new opportunity. I don't see anything particularly, leapfrogging right now. There are definitely opportunities, and there's definitely people who I think are jumping on a little bit too soon and assuming a little too much. I think that's just sort of, to me, it's sort of the normal pace of things. I'm not sure. Do you see it differently?
I would agree, personally, because and it's a good job this is audio only, Mike. They can't see the battle scars. It feels to me very much like, the web in the 90s and mobile. It's very much the same sort of hype cycle. Every 10 to 15 years, there's something new. And you know what always happens? It always ends up meeting more developers because more stuff gets built, right?
Yeah. I think that's right.
But because we've had this, especially in the last year, a whole bunch of layoffs, everything is cyclical, right? But developer relations itself has been particularly hit, which, it's adjacent to APIs. It's not the same thing. But I fear that the message which was starting to get through, that looking after your developer community is essential to making your API work, as essential as having, redundant load balancers. I feel it might be getting harder to justify, right?
It might right now. I definitely see that, and I have partners who are definitely telling me they're cutting back. They're not hiring as many people, or they're changing their focus. Or they're concerned. They're just plain concerned about what's happening in their own niche, in their own market space. I think in general, here's the way I think about it. If you can use a technology to improve the life of your consumers, improve the life of your colleagues, your peers inside an organization, improve the quality of product, whether that's information or physical, or whether it's tangible or not, then I'm all for it. And I don't think that means we need less people doing things. I don't think it means we need less person-to-person communication. If you can improve all of those things, I think that's great. The way they used to talk about it with the early part of the web and all these other things is we were augmenting human intelligence. We were making things better for humans. That's what we want to do. I think that's great. And I think there's lots of opportunity for that. And developer relations in particular can really take advantage of this kind of advancement so that I can focus more on person to person and help focus on, remember, we're solving other people's problems, not ours. I think we can do that really, really well. Yeah. If I'm using it to cut a corner, to lower the number of people who are actually doing person-to-person interactions, to try to automate that in some way as a chatbot rather than a person, I don't think it's gonna last. I don't think it's gonna play well, and I don't think it's going to actually be a marked improvement. And I don't think that'll last a long time. That's kind of the way I think about it right now.
Yeah, that's a hopeful outlook. Which, you know, I feel fairly. I would kind of agree, right? Because developers notice which companies have a value system that focuses on developers and which don't, right? For sure. I mean, it's sort of a hidden secret, right? That people ask me for API recommendations all the time. And, you know, if you look after developers.
Exactly. And that's right. And it's a word of mouth business. It's like developers will tell you, right? Yeah. They'll tell you right away. Oh, you want to be careful because they're going to this and that and the other, and whether it's the way the pricing model works or the quality of the actual API itself or the quality of the documentation or the quality of the support, that stuff gets around. And automating that away is hardly ever the right strategy. When you're creating a product for someone, reducing the quality touches, reducing the amount of interactions is not a good measure for success. And I think that's the same no matter what you're working on. I think changing the relationship between provider and consumer, improving that relationship and making people more partners, making it possible for consumers to customize more safely and easily, to actually get closer and closer to solving their specific problem with fewer and fewer demands, that's a quality operation. And if you can do that through good design, through good implementation, through the use of artificial intelligence, through design and implementation and maintenance, then I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. There is a perspective on this, which has just occurred to me. And it comes from a meeting I just had an hour ago with our junior developers. And we have a regular weekly kind of study group. We are currently working through Dave Thomas's book, The Pragmatic Programmer.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a good one. And the topic came up about how developer experience and the work, the tools that we have improved, but also leadership's buy-in. So I was explaining how, you know, let's say 15 years ago, I won't say it was 20 because it was 20. I remember having arguments with leadership about needing to invest in unit testing.
Yeah,
along the lines of, well, why isn't the code, why are you writing buggy code in the first place, right?
Yes, right.
Whereas now it's a best practice, and it's inconceivable that you wouldn't have unit tests. Inconceivable. So it feels like this change and the tooling that AI brings, I wonder, will it have the same go in the same way 10 years from now? It would be inconceivable that you're not using AI in certain ways that we can't really predict yet.
Right.
Our work as software developers and our interactions with APIs and all this. I'm not predicting because I don't know what they'll be, but
sure.
In the same way, it becomes absorbed into the best practices.
Yes, I think in general, that's the correct point of view. Like, I share that point of view. So obviously I think it's correct since I agree with you.
You mentioned Tribbles earlier, right? So I'm just gonna riff on that because if you think about Star Trek, right? We're such nerds here, but if you think about all of the interactions that they've, and they're actually not that many, the interactions that they have with the computer systems and the coding, where the coding is more of a collaborative exercise with the machine.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting vision for the future, and written not by people who are coders, but someone without any of our biases, right? Yeah. About what an interaction, an engineering interaction with a machine would look like. I wonder maybe.
So, are you thinking? Let me just go ahead and dig into this a little bit. Are you thinking about how AI can help change the way humans and machines interact? Is that what you're talking
about?
No,
it's about coding specifically, right?
Coding specifically.
Yeah, yeah. So there never seems to be a problem with versioning or refactoring or any of that sort of stuff, right? If you think about the Star Trek, maybe I'm stretching the metaphor a little bit. When you think about the Star Trek interactions where Geordi or somebody like that is recoding some system, it's always in collaboration with the ship's computer. Which isn't like a Terminator level AI. It's much more like a ChatGPT in that it's not sentient as such. So there's some coding task or some outcome, but the machine is looking after the refactoring and perhaps the unit testing and the integration testing and this all of this toil. The toil that we have to go through, configuring YAML deployment files, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Now, maybe the writers didn't write that because they didn't know about it because they're not coders. But wouldn't it be great if the AI could just sort out all that rubbish for us?
No, I think I understand where you're heading, and I agree with you 100% in the sense that, when I think about this, this idea of what does the future look like and What are advancements in this world looking like? I actually look to biology. I look to this notion of change over time, slow change over time, and the ability to interact constantly. This notion that there's always something running somewhere, right? TCP is always running somewhere.
Yeah.
And taking advantage of the version of TCP you have and the fact that it's backward compatible to all the other versions that you were using. So a great example of this is the S3 buckets we were talking about from Amazon.
Right.
The very first version written 15 years ago still works today.
Yes.
It still works today. The very first web page that was published by Tim Berners-Lee in the late 80s still works today. So there's a consistency in a continuation. And I think that's a big part of what testing and planning and versioning and all those things that we do today, I think might be a little bit ham-handed, but I do see how they will be, they're still going to go on, but they're going to be a fundamental part of the system we're working in, which is kind of what I think is encouraging to me.
Yeah, and of course, it is old cyclical, right? Because if you worked on the old mainframe systems or SAP's R3 or whatever, you're like, well, we already did all that stuff.
Yeah,
we had solved all this stuff already.
Yes, we solved all this already. This is fine. I'll just write some CICS and I'll be done with it.
Exactly. Mike, we're gonna have to say goodbye because we'll move on to Deep Space Nine, and then we will really lose all credibility. Right.
That's exactly right.
Thank you so much. Some things to think about.
Yeah, I had a great time. It was great to talk with you, Richard, and awesome. I hope we can do it again some other time.
For sure. Thank you, Mike.
You can find the transcript of this podcast and any links mentioned on the podcast section of our website, voxgig.com/podcast. Subscribe to the VoxGig Developer Relations Podcast on Apple, Spotify, or any podcasting platform. We publish each Tuesday and Thursday. You can also access the archive of our meetup talks on the VoxGig YouTube channel or the VoxGig website. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.